Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an x-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Sharon.
My name is Ed.
And I'm Sean.
And today on the show, we are talking about A Hole in the Heart, Season 4, Episode 22. But it's not just that we're discussing, is it? Because, you know, lips tremble. It's our final episode for now, I should say. Yep.
For now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's recorded. It's recorded. No takesies, backsies.
Yeah. This is going to be the last one for a bit. How is everybody feeling?
Sad.
Yeah.
Sad.
Sad too. Very, very sad.
We will remain in contact as friends.
Absolutely. And, you know, our love for ER will never die down.
Yeah. I'm probably going to carry on watching it just because.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, gosh, yeah.
I just think it's getting into season 5.
Well, that's true. And also, the end of it, like, I'm sad but exhilarated because I've just finished watching this episode and it kind of like ends on a. Ah!
Oh, it's a. Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. It ends. I think it's interesting because obviously they knew that they would be getting a season 5, so they don't have to worry about wrapping stuff up. Actually, what this one kind of does is it just sets a lot of things in motion and kind of makes you go, oh, my gosh, I have to tune back in because I want to know about this or that or this. So shall we get into the episode?
I think so.
Yes.
So I was going to start with Benton and Corday just because I feel like their story is quite separate to kind of everybody else seems a bit more entwined. So I'm going to start with, Benton and Corday, who we meet, you know, getting on the L and they're discussing the night before. And Benton is not happy with Corday because she asked for a song and because she wanted to stay later. Like, yeah.
He's definitely reverting to type a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's really depressing to see. If it's a follow on, say, from last week where he did, he was open and said, look, we discussed this obviously in the previous episode where, you know, he is struggling to come to a place of comfort with the fact that he, as a black man who has grown up in Chicago, is now dating a white woman who is not only not from Chicago, but not from the country, and is quite, she is positively ignorant, if you like, of a lot of the experiences, the lived experiences. Mm. And so it seems then that their time in the Velvet Room featured another example of this positive ignorance. She went to a show and requested a song. So this is from where she came. It's like, oh, I think this was great. This would be cool. Whereas he really, 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 he speaks to her in such a way of, it's very placating. It's very patronizing.
Yes. Yeah.
And it seems to be almost undoing some of the steps that he had made or that he had seemed to make in terms of being more open. I kind of caught myself thinking this week going, there wasn't so much a spark fizzling out between them as the match never took.
Yes.
Yeah, it made me really angry because it was one of those things where, you know, you get somebody in a relationship or you get like a woman in a relationship who's just this kind of vivacious, go-getting kind of, and you get somebody else who feels like they're insecure and they need to kind of, you know, rein that in and kind of, I found it quite difficult to watch because I thought, stop trying to kind of belittle her and talk her down and have an adult conversation. You know, if she did something that he deemed, you know, in his kind of what he obviously, as we said, you know, knows more about everything that's going on and has that lived experience, explain it and just say, look, this is the reason. Don't just be like, oh, you know, you should know. And oh, you should. It felt really like not manipulative. What's the word? A bit abusive in the terms of like, you know, really trying to undermine her as a person rather than kind of go, these were the issues. Like, he's obviously feeling, I don't know if there's like, he's finding bits of this difficult, we know that, and instead of kind of remembering that, he's trying to, like, it feels like he's just trying to push her away or trying to, you know, it's just not great.
Actually, exactly what you said there, that he's trying to push her away, it's like he's I'm sure all of us have probably known someone or we know of situations where rather than breaking up with someone, people will sort of introduce so many issues to get the other person to break up with them.
Yeah.
And oh, it's, yeah. I'm not going to massively pass judgment on it. Everyone has their own reasons, but it is incredibly frustrating to see this happening.
Yes.
And I don't think Lizzie's not picking up on this. I think she is directly going, no, screw you. Like, we're going to have some fun, whether you want it or not. Because I think it's certainly at the beginning of this episode, she still is having fun, even though he's trying to make it difficult for her. And I do think over the course of the episode, with when a couple of other bits come into their story, I think she enters the episode and leaves the episode with a very different mindset on Peter Bent.
Yes. I think as well, it's also with Benton, and maybe she knows this, maybe she doesn't. It's not coming from a place of, I want us to split up because I don't like you anymore. Or this is, it's coming from a, he's afraid, I think, about this. Yeah. So his natural reaction is to kind of, you know, break it apart rather than actually be truthful and kind of sit with it. And I think, I don't know if she knows that or not, but I wonder if that contributes to her kind of keep going on and stuff. And that's why I think it's even harder to watch, because it's like, you know, you really like this person. Yeah. And there's a moment actually a little bit later, which I'll come to in a moment, where it really proves that he does really want to be in this couple. You know, there are things that he wants from her that he's not great about kind of saying. To take Benton for a second, so he picks up Reese and has to drop Reese in at daycare, which he does, and you know, the carer there actually says to him, you know, have you ever had Reese's hearing checked, because he's not always the most responsive. And you know, Benton is at, I think, what most people would do, which is, you know, kind of defends him, and he's like, oh no, it's fine, it's not an issue, look. And he's like calling Reese, and then he finally gets his attention. He says, oh, he's just distracted by whatever. But what's interesting is at the end he kind of turns and looks at Reese, and you can see that the seed has been planted, that actually maybe that's what, also when he kind of thinks a bit about when he's been at home with Reese, and there have been moments where maybe Reese hasn't always been responsive, maybe it's starting to dawn on him, actually, should he get something should he get him tested?
I was, and there's a bit of knowing what's coming in this, but there was almost like a gong was being hit when she said, have you ever had his hearing checked? This begins.
I just want to go back to the relationship that you, when you talk about the honest relationship, you think about Carol and Doug recently, where Carol just opened up and said, I push you away because I'm scared you're going to go anyway. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That contrast of I don't want to label Benton and Corday's relationship as unhealthy, but at the same time, Doug and Carol's relationship is very healthy in that regard. But like the whole thing about making a song request, he goes, that's not cool. Like, well, did she request, you know, the word, I've got a brand new combine harvester, or did she request like a decent jazz standard? Do you know what I mean? Like, what was the reaction in the bar? He's just going on about this. Like, I'll just try to think of the least appropriate song in that instance.
The song.
Oh my goodness.
But her attitude to like, oh, coolness, whatever. I just was like, oh, I couldn't love her more, but yeah, I do.
The thing I wanted to know more about that we didn't get was what is the song, and was it that it wasn't cool because that she'd asked for, or was it that you don't ask for songs, you know, is it as a white woman you don't go in there and ask for songs? That was the thing that I was a bit like, what is it, what's going on?
Yeah,
I wonder if it's maybe a holdover to particularly pick up on the point of, as a white woman going in there and bringing attention to herself.
Yes.
And his struggle was kind of like, you know, he initially didn't want to bring her anywhere near the Velvet Room and these type of clubs, you know, because it's how would you phrase it? Maybe what I do in the privacy of my own bedroom is not what I want to show off to the world.
Yes,
there was a little bit of that. And then What does she do? Only she stands up in the middle of this place and says, oh, I'd like to request a song, please. You know, from his point of view, going, everyone, Peter Benton brought me. I'm here because of Peter Benton.
Yes.
And yeah, you can see that. I don't know. And do you know what? This isn't even a knowing what's coming in season five. Even this would be enough to be like, guys, this isn't going to work out, is it? Like, there's too much of a discomfort level.
Yeah, definitely. And a non-communication about that. You know, Benton's not great at going, look, while this is going on, can we, I need to do it in baby steps. So maybe if we do go to the Velvet Lounge, you aren't the one going kind of up and doing that. You know, if you had that communication, just said a bit slower, a bit, maybe it would have had a chance. But yeah, as you say, I mean, then we hear that Benton has actually called the audiologist, and not that we see that actually that doesn't happen in this episode of seeing the outcome, but we know that he's called him. And I thought that was a nice little touch to kind of say that actually Benton has taken that on board and is going to check that, rather than being in denial about the whole thing. Meanwhile, poor Corday, so she gets a letter from Romano. And it's obviously not good news. We don't find out what it is straight away, but she goes to try and obviously find him. He's in Costa Rica at a head and neck surgery, even though that's not what his speciality is.
Talk about running away. It's a medical thing. Okay, bye.
Yeah, gotta go. Like, he looked for the first kind of medical thing he could to get him out of there.
I don't think he was in Costa Rica. I think he was hiding.
At home.
Yeah, hiding at home or just in a cupboard.
Cupboard, you know, somewhere. I mean? Just
under his Anspar's jacket.
In his pouch, yeah.
Yeah, oh God. Yeah, absolutely. You know, this, what an absolute coward, you know. He drops the news and runs out of the way, you know. And you think that if this was like a proper professional person with a proper professional non-coward way, he would sit her down and say, look, I'm not going to renew, these are the reasons, or let's have a conversation. But he doesn't. He drops the news, runs away like a little baby. And it obviously, we see most of this episode is Corday trying to track him down, and then when she can't, she's trying to, you know, find another doctor to sponsor her, and she's kind of, you know, that's her mission, that is kind of where her laser focus is on. Unfortunately, that means she isn't around in the ER when, you know, the traumas are coming in, and Benton kind of has to cover. And then Benton ends up going, so they go up, you know, Benton and Anspar are in surgery, Corday walks in because that should have been her role. And she comes in, and the first thing she does is basically ask Anspar to sponsor her. And that's where it comes out that actually, you know, this Romano has not continued it. And Corday's reaction to that has been to just immediately go out and get somebody new to sponsor her. You see Benton quite shocked, you know, and a bit like, oh, when he finds this news out. And then what we get is, well, it's we have that brilliant moment where that I never know what she is, if she's the surgical nurse or if she's something else, but you know, she's like, if you want to stay in the States, well, you just need to get married. And Benton is a bit like, not to me, not, you know, that pressure is on him. But the thing where you can see that he does care is when he says she's apologizing to him because she left him with the ER to kind of cover that while she was running around trying to find a new sponsor. And he says, why didn't you page me about Romano? And it, you can see that actually that's a real boyfriend thing. I want to know what's going on in your life. And unfortunately, she was so kind of focused on trying to track him down that she didn't even give a thought to the fact that she would need to talk to Benton. And then again, so this is a moment where I don't know if this is, Lizzie, you know, we know she's very direct. Her thing is, I'm going to go and just ask doctors. Benton really hates this. And I don't know if this is because he says that to her, like, oh, it's very desperate. What I wasn't sure about was if that was an American, you know, like, I can't imagine it, because Americans are quite direct, aren't they? But, and go-getty, you know?
Yeah.
I don't, was this, again, him being embarrassed because she's kind of, but he's nasty to her about it. And
yep.
And absolutely. Again.
Like, he's the same person yeah. that would be, he, like, we've seen him in the past do whatever he can, work 75 million hours a week, you know, absolutely fight his way to get noticed, to get recognized. But when Lizzie just speaks to Anspa in the middle of a surgery,
yeah,
suddenly it's, oh, this is embarrassing. And how could you do that? It looks desperate. I'm just like,
yeah,
Peter, not saying that you didn't work like you did. You worked incredibly hard to get where you are, but like, you have no relationships because of what you've done to get to where you are. But Lizzie is your relationship, and now you seem to be trying to ruin that as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's, and then he does that thing where he really, really basically tries to push her away. And he says, you know, you could try other hospitals and other places across America. And she's like, well, I wanted to stay here because I thought I'd been building relationships, obviously talking about him. Mm. And I think it's really painful for her because that is why she wants to stay. A big part of it is kind of him and the other stuff that she's done. And for him to kind of talk down and make out like that whatever they're exploring isn't worth it or important, you know, must have just been so horrible to hear.
And especially, you could have tried anywhere else. It's almost like saying, oh, you have an issue. I don't want it to be my issue and I don't want it to be in my hospital, but you have an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're on your own, not actually, you know, Corday, I'm going to also talk to people, or actually I know of so-and-so, or, you know, there is no attempt of him to try and keep her there. And in fact, he's very much very flippant about the fact that she could go anywhere else, like it doesn't bother him. And it made me really angry. I was like, oh, come on, be a better man and don't talk to her like that. And it was interesting as well, because they both kind of had a bit of an argument about the fact that they've both had to work very hard to get to where they have. And he's obviously talking from kind of a black male perspective, and she's talking from a kind of female, maybe even being foreign into America, you know. And I just thought that was interesting, because there are parts of each other that is unknowing to the other, and is, you will never be able to really explain away. So it's a horror. I didn't like the Benton in this episode.
I totally agree. And I think even worse is that how quickly he's judging her. Like, oh, you haven't done any of these things. I got the letter like 20 minutes ago, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what was I supposed to do? Run down to the non-existent internet and, you know, fire off a bunch of emails that are like slower than carrier pigeon at this time.
Exactly. You know? And also the fact that, you know, I don't really know how visas and things work, but maybe she needs to secure a role quickly, because otherwise they will deport her. You know, it's there are so many factors, and he's just really not great with her. No. I'm going to move us over to kind of Anna and Max and Carter, because this was, again, another one that felt like it was a bit on the side of everything else. When we first see kind of Anna and Max, they're both really excited because they rode the L with the driver, which I just thought was so...
That was so cute.
That was so cute.
You know, they're so excited about it. They kind of come in and they're reveling from it. And they seem very coupley, you know, at this point. Carter comes in and couldn't care less. He just does not want to know about
this. He's just so awkward with them and just so horrible.
He is Debbie Downer in this episode.
I just love Debbie Downer.
Yeah. Like, you know, kind of, oh my God, have you ever done this?
No, don't want to. That's not good at all.
All right, John, you're all right, are you?
I know, he's proper Eeyore, isn't he? I can't ride the
L between her hair issues. Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah. and so then we get, so Max is basically going to be around a bit, he says to Anna. He's got to write now. He's kind of gathered all the information. He now has to write the report. He says, you know, I'm going to be around. And then he actually kind of really says to her, what normally happens when I write one of these is they ask me to run it. And normally I say no, but this time I'm considering it, which is, you know, really interesting. He's obviously saying to her, I want to try again and I want to start again. Meanwhile, also in the background, the Percocet went missing. So we have that scene where Carter's kind of looking at something and Lydia comes up and says, oh, this Percocet's missing. And then they do this brilliant camera kind of reveal of Max, and Carter's looking at Max. He does not go about things in the best way. He goes to tell Anna, doesn't he, straight away?
Mm-hmm. He was... So the fact that it happens to be a bottle of Percocet, I nearly saw him doing a backflip.
Yeah.
Because if someone stubbed their toe, he would have gone to Anna and said, didn't stub their toe before Max arrived, did they?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, he goes straight out to talk to Anna. Anna does not want to hear this. This is not, you know, she's very much like, well, he's clean. And no matter what it is that she's feeling inside, she doesn't need this from him, you know, and pushing this in his face. And he kind of says, well, actually, Chase used to tell me he was clean. And I get that Carter's very, this is a really hot button sensitive issue for Carter right now, but just let it play out. Don't you become an agent in it and try to force the issue.
If you think it's going to, like, if you genuinely believe that he's just going to mess up again in the future, he's just going to relapse, then... I was going to say, fine, just let it happen. I guess then you'd be like, well, as a good friend, I don't want to see you go through this. But sorry, Carter, there's no way your motives are altruistic here.
No.
They're just not.
They're not. And there's a difference, isn't there, with wanting to protect a friend and going about it the right way, like going up and being like, the Percocet's missing, you know, is... Not that I think the only time you could do something like that is if you actually physically saw Max take it, you know, and you could be like, I saw him take it, I'm worried about you. The fact that you haven't seen him take it, I would just have, you know, just step back, and just let her know, you know, that you're there for her, you know. Oh, I think, you know, show that you're not a judgmental person, because if he did take the Percocet and she finds out, she might not want to run to Carter with that information. Yeah. Because
I'm it's a, right.
I told you so, exactly.
Yeah.
And actually that's what happens with Anna and Max. They kind of discuss it, doesn't they? He says he's the one who brings up, he says the Percocet's missing, and he's very, very, I don't mind if you thought it was me, I'd actually expect you would think it was me. And for me, it felt like a really adult conversation. And he's, I mean, you can't 100% know that it wouldn't have been him, but to be able to have these conversations just seems like growth. And it seems, yeah, if they are going to ever try again, these are the conversations they need to have, you know, and these are the boundaries and things they need to, yeah, discuss. Yeah, so that it kind of sets up the kind of that dynamic of Carter still being annoyed, but actually, you know, Max might possibly stay, especially with Doug messing up so much, you know, that if he does talk about this attending ERP thing, he might be the one to get that job. And mm-hmm. Anna's obviously now got her life there, and he's talking about staying. So it kind of sets all that up. I have to say, I found Carter's storylines really weird this week. And a bit,
oh my God, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And a bit
boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like this Mrs. Lang comes in with Mr. Lang, and he's in a coma and he couldn't wake up, and they realize that actually the reason he can't wake up is because this tumor of his has kind of grown, and they can try and get rid of it, but his recovery will be tough. And problematic is the word Carter actually uses. And he seems to be really pushing Mrs. Lang he says he could die peacefully now, kind of as he is, which seems to be where he's pushing her, sorry. And then later he comes back to find Mr. Lang and Mrs. Lang, and Mr. Lang's been transferred. And then Carter says to Carol, you know, what happened? I'm just really interested to know what happened. And Carol's a bit confused, saying, well, actually, you know, we have people all the time and we don't know the outcome. Why is it this one? Yeah. I didn't know what was going on in this episode with Carter.
It was like it was almost bits and pieces of older storylines, just kind of like, oh, we have these lines thrown around, chuck them into Carter this week.
Yeah. I was like, what is he trying to say about this?
Well, he was saying at the start he was feeling really disillusioned about being in the ER. I'm like,
yeah.
Well, because you've had to do some scut work
Yeah. And well, I was like, is that because of Anna? Is that because you're seeing Anna and Max?
Yeah.
And he just wants to kind of get away. And, you know, sometimes you have, you know, you're doing your job and you're okay and you're fine with all the kind of parts of it you hate. And other days you're like, I can't do this anymore. And sometimes something pushes on that. But I just didn't really understand. I didn't care about this Mr. and Mrs. Lang thing. And I didn't know why Carter cared so much to be like, I wanted to know what happened. And I thought, what is this storyline? It just, to me, was just very strange. And it wasn't enough Carter for me, as we would all expect to know.
Of course.
It's like, oh, I don't know.
It was not even half of one thing, you know. It was just, as you say, it was some spare bits of storyline, and we maybe want to make a point about, you know, Carter doing more pastoral care with the wife, but then that came to nothing. She just whipped him off to another hospital.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it was just like, okay. And then the other storyline that I found was a bit like this was with the Elvi, you know, the two Elvises, which felt like, they really built that up. These two people are coming in. It's a trauma. It's a blah. They come in. They're arguing. It's like, this is going to become something.
Yeah.
And then it just goes nowhere. And it's like, one goes off to surgery and that we never hear from them again. And I was like, why I'm also bringing that up is because if you read any of the synopsis for this episode, it brings up the Elvises as if it's going to be something. Yeah. And it's really isn't. Not. I was just like, again, I was a bit like, what is this about? Like, I
thought they were going to mine it for comedic value, or and they do a little bit. They sort of have them, the older Elvis and the younger Elvis fighting about who's the best, and you can't even sing dance like him, and that was it. But the thing is, like, it was like a throwback, because sometimes they've done like slight background gags, and occasionally you've seen like just loads of Elvis impersonators coming out of the lift or going up the stairs, something like that.
Yeah,
and I thought there'd be, but it was like, I was the same. I was like, they're all
and
right.
And also the way that they present them. So they're both kind of come out of the ambulances, and I just thought, you can't even really tell that they're Elvis person. Like, that hadn't even been enough, you know.
Be careful,
and
they'll come after us. They'll come after us.
Sorry. that was just another part of this that I was a bit like, I just didn't know what was going on. I'm going to take it to Doug now, because I think Doug is obviously the big center. He's the central line, you know, central storyline going through this. He's the central line.
No, he's the central line. Yeah.
And he's an essential line. Anyway. because the episode actually picks up like literally minutes after the last episode ended, you know. So it opens in the lift at the PICU with baby Josh being looked after by Doug and by Weaver, and Weaver is yelling at Doug as she's wanting to.
She spent the whole lift ride having a go at him. Clearly, that was the impression.
And the whole week, maybe in between. Do you think?
Yeah, the longest elevator ride.
The elevator stuck for 5 days. Yeah,
yeah.
Including that time he was trapped in the elevator with the little girl they were trying to keep alive.
You know, they end up on the PEDS unit, the PICU, and it's funny actually, because the anesthesiologist, the PEDS anesthesiologist, comes over, and a Weaver really thinks, here's my ally. I can be like, look at this Doug, what he did, you know. She's really trying to run that home, and the anesthesiologist just turns around and is like, this is amazing, like, wow. And what did you use? And maybe we should use propofol instead of this. And and actually ends up, you know, being on Doug's side, which, you know, starts the weave, because Weaver is at frustration station this week, and this starts the train for her getting there. You know, this is the moment she's like, this guy is breaking all these rules, and everybody around him are like, yeah. And she's like, why are you all saying yeah when he's done all these terrible things, you know?
It is. It's like, I feel for Weaver this week. I do.
Yeah. I do too.
I guess no one is saying Doug was right.
No.
But Anspar does say, I mean, like, he says something that would surely, like, I don't know whether he said it to annoy Kerry, or he's like, oh, say what you like, though, he's there for his patients. She's like, oh my God, she's going to kill him. She's going to take that crutch and wallop him over the head.
It is. He'll be in the ICU next. yeah, it's that, isn't it? It's, And it's awful because, you know, she's having this issue with Doug and everybody around doesn't seem to be taking it as seriously, which for her is, it must be horrible when you think finally this person has crossed the line so far that we've got him, and then everybody turns around and is like, actually, no, you know, it's fine. And she's like, no, it's not. Well, let's go with Weaver, actually, because, you know, she goes upstairs to talk to Anspar. Green has said to her, we need a meeting with Anspar about the Doug thing. She's very much like, I'm going to meet him now, but not about the Doug thing. It's about something else. Green is insistent that when they talk about Doug, he wants to be in the room.
Yeah.
But when she goes up, actually what she wanted to talk to him about was the fact that she has been acting chief and she wants to make it permanent and real and, you know, not be acting anymore. So she kind of says, you know, I've worked really hard. Everybody in the ER is respecting my authority. We've got...
Almost everyone.
Mm. But, you know, yeah. So she's very presenting her case, only to find out that Anspar is actually, you know, they're opening it up nationwide, basically. I get that they have to do that, yeah, which is fine, but I thought it was really bad that they hadn't at any point said that to her, or I don't know, it didn't seem like she was she was being considered either. He kind of was, okay, we could put you in, like, wouldn't you be like, right, we've got to do this nationwide, is it something you'd like to do, we'd like you to apply. Yeah. I don't, just those little conversations probably would have.
Yeah, I see your point, because I was sort of looking at it in isolation when I was watching it last night and thought, I think the assumption that she would just have the job was also...
I agree with that. But it's just like, they could have handled it better.
Definitely, and I see your point as well that, and, you know, Donald... We're on first name terms.
Me and Donnie.
Yeah, we've been down the golf club together.
I don't know why I don't play golf. That's where you were this morning.
Yeah, I've had several whiskeys already. That why do you think I sound so tired and hoarse?
Until you play your best game.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I smashed a few windows and hit a few people with my golf clubs, but come on.
Actually, what were they doing in the way of your golf clubs anyway? Come on now.
I mean, just because they're in the living room of the house. But yeah, I agree. But at the same time, that's what happens in these. It's a major role in a city hospital.
I was wondering nearly, should Carrie have been part of the selection process?
Yeah, that,
you know,
would make sense.
The person who's, you know, if she is a placeholder for the moment, should she be part of the interview panel? And if that is the case, then they were absolutely wrong for not having the conversation with her. Now, if she was, if for example, let's say Anspar is being a bit of a cheeky fecker here, and actually she very much is in the running, and that's why they haven't had the conversation with her. Okay, sure. As a person who sometimes I have tried to surprise friends of mine, and it's just totally blown up in my face, like, oh no, I was doing a nice thing, but no, I see why it's ended up this way. Hang on. Yeah. So I wonder if...
I think for me, the thing that doesn't make sense, because you would, if somebody, so... It felt to me like she went in to say that and he was like, oh, would you like to be considered? Like, he hadn't even thought about it. And I think if you know that you have to do it nationwide and all that stuff, I would have said to her, is this something you want to put your...
Yeah.
That would be the first thing you would say to the person who is acting. You know, this is what we have to do. Is this something you want to be... Are you going to put your name in? If not, then be part of the selection committee. If you are, great, you know, we're doing this. It just felt very much like he was like, oh yeah, you know. And I can see why she feels a little bit unthought about and unloved and a bit unconsidered, you know, because he's just a bit like shocked, seems to be a bit shocked that she wants to. He also brings up Dr. Ellis again, which I thought was just, you know, well, there was that unfortunate business with Dr. Ellis, and it's like the one mistake she's made is just dragged up.
Do you know what I will say though? He does have a point.
Oh no, he really does. It's the way, it's just how he did it. A bit like, oh, you know, I could see why, again, you know, this is getting her to the next part of getting her on her journey to frustration station, because all these little things are happening. You know, and then she kind of So she goes downstairs and Green starts having a go at her because he's like, you had this meeting without me. Because that's the other thing. So when she comes up to speak to Anspar, she's ambushed with this meeting that because Doug has basically outplayed her by going to Anspar first.
So he played the game and you don't expect it, but he really, that saved his skin.
It did. It did. He puts his hands up, doesn't he? He goes straight to Anspar, says, look, I did this. This is my report. This is, you know, the baby is fine. I would never, you know, basically just hat in hand, is that what you say? And
yeah,
you know, very remorseful and like, this is what I did, and gets out there first. And is again very, very clearly says about the peds attending role, you know, I agree we need to have it. It doesn't have to be me. You know, really, he seems really contrite, doesn't he? And really like,
But you know, when I've done it, and I'm sure at some point one of our listeners have done it, and one of you may have done it, when you've made a big cock up at work, you've done something quickly, you've not thought about it, what's the thing you do? You either try and hide it and it gets worse, or you go to your manager and go, I've made a mistake, this is why, can we fix it? Because I want to fix it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that works. It will work. It
does. Let me tell you about a funny time, right? It was one of my first weeks working. I was working as part of a marketing team for a supermarket chain. We would install and we would remove just point of sale merchandising. Sounds simple. Anyway, so totally misread the date of the end of a campaign, right? So I do the brief. I send it out to 40 guys or something on the road. They go in, they do their job. Nothing wrong. Pull out all the POS. That's grand. Chuck it in the bin. That's grand. Yeah. I then realize I had actually done it a month early.
Oh, no.
So that meant then that's the client had paid for a month of advertising that suddenly they didn't have. So it's just like, I was just like, there's no, like, no. So straight into my, and considering I'm maybe 2 weeks in the job at this point, I'm just like, hi, boss. Do you have a minute? they were so good about, and that's what it was one of the first times where it was just like, oh no, just put your hands up if you've made a mistake. You know, there's nothing worse than trying to hide something, because then not only are you constantly trying to hide it, but you're looking over your shoulder and there's no guarantee that it will pay off.
And they'll find out. They usually find out.
Of course they will.
It makes you look dishonest and untrustworthy rather than somebody who's made a mistake. Let's face it, we've all made mistakes.
Yeah,
absolutely. We're all human. You know, so that is what Doug has done. He's kind of gone about it in that kind of way, which makes, you know, Weaver's just, you know, seething. She gets downstairs and Green's found out they had that meeting. So he's having a go at her and she's like, well, no, I was ambushed. But then, and I actually thought this was brilliant of Weaver, she says to him, she says, well, I am mad at you because I feel like this is your fault, because anytime Doug does anything, you've let him, and then if you're going to give him that inch, he's going to take that mile. And anytime I try to come down on the side of, you know, what's right, you get mad at me, and this is what happens when you know, you do that. Yeah. And she says to him, which is so, you know, really encapsulating, is something we've all discussed about Green, is that he does stick his head in the sand and hope that things just pass by. So I'm really glad she did that, because he does shirk a lot of that responsibility and expect her to do it.
Absolutely. And I think we've talked about this before, haven't we, where it's, you know, Mark is... it's like he's attending in name only.
Yes.
You know, yes, he is the boss, sure. And yes, he works hard. There's no question of that. But you need to know where something is in the admin pile, ask Weaver.
Yeah, exactly
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And also, I think it'd be different if that was your strength and you knew, look, my weakness is the admin-y side or that side, but my strength is kind of the pastoral, or, you know, being the person on the ground to lead. But then... you know that about yourself, then you should back the person who is good at the admin. Yeah. You should back the person who does try to set the rules down, because that's the only way it's going to work. You kind of can't have your cake and eat it. And so I'm really glad Weaver kind of stands up for herself there. All the way through the episode, she's got this patient called Mr. Wass, who is on this certain medication. His insurance have said they're not going to give this medication. It's something that he could have at home, basically. The insurance have said, no, he has to have this other medication. And for him to have that, he has to be admitted to hospital, which will actually cost more. So she says, you know, you are spending 5,000 to say 500 or something like that. It's just, so she's, we see her on the phone, just trying to fight this ridiculous insurance thing, coming up against the bureaucracy she loves so much and tries to uphold so much herself and nobody else does. And she, at that point, is had enough, you know, she's like, fine, admit him, I quit. I'm sick of being the acting chief. I'm sick of being the only one who kind of puts my head above and does all that work. If everybody else, like Doug, can basically, you know, put his, you know, flip off the administration and get away with it. And she's there. And I thought, this is so interesting because I feel a bit like Weaver in this. I'm very like that. I'm like, I play by all the rules. That person over there broke the rules, but is getting rewarded for it. And so I really understood why, where she was coming from and why she gets to this point where she just, she says, I'm not doing it anymore. I don't want to do this. And, you know, throws everything.
It's a sad moment. I do like how that little part of her story this week, I do like how they resolve it because it's quiet and I like the way how well it's done.
Yes.
But also it's just, she's so right. I mean, she does work really hard. Yes, she's not perfect. Nobody's perfect. And, you know, yes, she can be abrasive sometimes as well. But even in the middle of all of this episode, everything that's going on, all of her anger toward Doug, her anger toward Mark, look at how she is with the little girl.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought that was almost, I don't think it was intentional on Anspaugh's part, but when Anspaugh goes, oh, you can't say he's not there for his patients. Well, so is she.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You we've know? Seen her time and time again. Look what she does for Mr. Wass. You know, she's on the phone to the insurance trying to make it so that he can, you know, have this treatment from home rather than have to be admitted. So, and we've seen her time and again be there for her patients. Yeah. And it's just, I think, because she's louder in other parts of her job, people see that and don't see where she's quieter, which is where she looks after the patients. And
another drug dependent patient she was helping, the guy who's a veteran. It was a few weeks ago. He came in and he was trying to, he nearly OD'd. Was he an amputee? Oh God, it's so bad. I can't remember. He was an Iber as well, but she was making deals with him to get into detox plans and things like that. Oh
yes, you're right. Yes. That she did. Exactly.
And she went to bat for him in not a dissimilar way to the way Doug has with baby Josh.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she was just a bit more canny about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and she's also doesn't cause splashes when she does it. Yes. So I don't think people notice, whereas Doug, that is what he does. And I think everybody has to see. And as you say, you know, basically at the end of the episode, a horrible, hideous trauma comes in.
Oh, yeah.
And she just steps right back up into kind of running the ER, which is, you know, really great and beautiful. And we see her with the little girl, Amy, just trying to look after her and be there for her. So, we've got this contrite Doug who is basically trying to continue the detox of baby Josh. Luckily, the anesthesiologist seems to be on his side and they want to help. We do have this moment with him and Carol where he says, you know, did I do the right thing? Do you think that he was genuinely asking that, or do you think he needed to hear her say yes?
Oh, he needed to hear her say yes. Yeah. He just needs to know, like, because Doug and Carol are a team. And when they're not together on something, that's when something is wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and I love as well throughout her conversations with him and with Mark and Kerry, she's just like, there's not even a hesitation.
Yeah.
Like, this was right. This was patient care to the extreme.
Yeah.
I was really mad at Green. The way he speaks to her, you know, everyone will understand you're a nurse. This is your job. She's like, I'm not a little ingenue who's just come in here and I'm being dazzled by this handsome doctor. I knew what I was doing. I have my own mind and my own choices. And this was the choice I made. And I was just like, good on you, Carol, because the way that everyone's like, write down what happened, you know, talk about how he had that gun to your head. And it's like, no, I was there. And actually, because we saw it, he said to her, go. And she said, no, I am staying. And she 100% believed in what he was doing and doing the best. And I just thought, God, it was so sexist to think that she was just being taken along by him and she has no will of her own.
And it is also the nurses, just they have to follow doctor's orders, which is true. But at the same time, you look at the fact that she started treating Mr. Nabel to begin with. She identified the psych, the need for a psych eval.
Yep.
She, do you know what I mean? She is more, and the nurses are expected to do more.
Yeah, and actually we've seen them do that. We've seen them question things, and we've seen them come up and say to the doctor, look, this person's coming, they've got this, can I give them this? You know, we've seen them do all of those things. So Doug kind of, you know, has all of that. Then the time comes to extubate baby Josh. Has what he's done worked? It has. Luckily, baby Josh is actually fine, and this has really worked out well. The mom comes in, which I thought was interesting, you know, because she's the reason that all this has ended up happening. You know, her kind of being back in the kid's life has caused Doug to kind of do this. And this is where the problem, I guess, which is what Weaver was discussing, is that the mom comes in and she says to him, can you do the same for me? And this is where I think Weaver's one of her points is, this is what happens. People will be like, we've done it for them. Can I have that same service?
I thought it was they added a crucial line after this, because I think this question was definitely coming.
Yeah.
And from what we saw last week only, great, Doug's cured addiction. So yeah. I do like that this week they said, now, yeah, maybe I can get you physically off the dependency, or he says, I give her a list of doctors who will help with this, but you have to have the will. Like, if you don't want to, cure is the wrong word, maybe get off your dependency to drugs.
Treat the physical dependency.
Yeah, it's different, isn't it, with the baby? Because a baby wouldn't understand or know. So to detox a baby would be very different to detoxing a person who is older and can make decisions and has that psychology already built in. So yeah, you know, he says, as much as I can detox somebody, or she could get detoxed, she also has to do a certain number of work that the baby wouldn't have to do. Absolutely. I thought that was a really, really good point. And we don't know, that's how they leave it. We don't really know if Doug is going to survive this or what's going to happen. We keep hearing about the fact that there's going to be an investigation. He even comes down, doesn't he? And he gives kind of Weaver and Green his action report and is again trying to get in front of it. But him and Green have a good, because Green starts kind of having a go at him, and Weaver chucks them both out and says, go talk about it outside. And they have an argument, which is the kind of argument they've always been having. You know, it's the same argument, I think. But this is what happens in relationships. You know, those same tensions are always kind of there, and they're hard to resolve. Where, you know, Green says he's angry at Doug because he goes after what he wants and he sabotages it. He wants Doug to have told him first. Doug says, well, you wouldn't have accepted what I wanted to do, so that's why I didn't come to you. And also, you like it when I screw up, that, you know, it makes you feel better. And then Doug, actually, I mean, I don't know who had this on their bingo card, but Doug comes out in defense of Weaver. You know, he's like, you have been mean to, you know, you are always really resentful about Weaver. You don't make her job.
Yeah.
And I thought he needed to hear that. He's already had Weaver turn around and say that to him, but now he's getting it confirmed by somebody who's a third party. And not just that, but somebody who is so not the person who would ever stick up for Weaver, to actually kind of stick up for her, I thought was really interesting.
Mark's just like, what bizarro world did I wake up in today?
Yeah. Now I know I'm dreaming.
Yeah. Checks the moon's in the right place, checks his watches, you know, reading right around, checks that everybody's got a goatee because they're in the mirror universe. It's another one of those points where in the real world, Mark and Kerry could have a great working relationship, and they understand each other's weakness and strengths, and that would avoid all the drama. And that's why this is like, well, you know, it's a TV show, that's why we create the drama. But yeah, it's I do feel for Kerry in this.
I do, I really do.
But there was something classic ER about them talking in the rain. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this all felt very classic ER this week, because we had Green being woken up by, you know, at the beginning by Connie. we have this horrible weather, we have these multiple traumas that come in, that means we're going from room to room. It just felt very classic ER, yeah. Which is why I think, you know, so much of the episode for me worked really well.
Also playing curling in the halls, that kind of that little minute of goof off that they have.
And we also get bits of Randy and Jerry in this, you know, yeah, there's a moment where she goes out to get his lunch and she's mad because it was raining so bad and she's soaked, and, you know, we just get all those little bits, but then they all get to kind of come together, and you always know it's a real epic moment when every single member of the ER absolutely team is working downstairs, because we do get that at the end, which we'll come to in a minute. So I think that's kind of Duggan and Weaver this week. I think we should go into Carol, because I think Carol is the one that, you know,
is the unified story.
Yes. So we've already discussed the fact that, you know, she's still backing Doug and people are trying to talk her down, and she's saying, nope, I did this is part of me, as you say. So Mr. Nabel comes in, he's hurt himself, it looks like a possible attempted suicide. He's very you know, it definitely wasn't, it was an accident, I got angry, I really don't need psych, unfortunately have to bring psych down. Psych say, look, we can't do anything. Basically, there's nothing remarkable about him. He is like everybody else that we see, you know, who's unhappy with their job or wife or this or that. There's nothing warranting them keeping him or having him there. He's also very against staying. Carol has looked into it, which is why she brings it up with Psych. She's looked into it. She said, look, I feel like there's a bit of a pattern here, because he's been in for a number of times for different things. Something is going on, some attention-seeking
drug-seeking behaviour potentially as well.
And potentially drug-seeking. Again, you know, it shows how tough it is to kind of decide who gets that help, because, yes, a lot of that's coming up, but so many people present like that. So actually, Psych say, look, we can't do anything. So Mr. Nabel goes, leaves. Later, Carol comes in and notices he's in the waiting room and he's covered in blood. God, and
this is so shocking.
It's brilliant ER writing, isn't it? This whole storyline. Somebody comes in who you don't even really think about. Later, he comes back. You know, he's covered in blood. She's trying to talk to him. She takes him. She's trying to figure out where the blood's coming from. She then is doing a search and he hands her the gun, basically. She realizes, you know, and he says the phrase, which I thought was just so chilling, there weren't enough bullets.
That is just spine tingling stuff. And then this whole time you have that background noise of the car alarm.
So the car alarm and then they don't make it a thing, but Jerry just goes, that car alarm. So they just bring your attention to it. And then as you say, it's adding that note of tension to Mark and Doug's argument
in the rain.
The rain is this layered sensory experience.
It's really brilliant. Like you could put this on in that scene on in a 4D cinema, you know, and kind of have people and because it's just very cinematic. And and obviously Carol then realizes, because then also Mr. Nabel says, that's my car, the alarm just goes off sometimes. So she's like, bullets, not enough bullets, blood, car. She runs out, she stops Green and Mark, that's the same person, Green and Ross fighting, and she gets, they all have to go to the car, and because it's raining they can't tell, they're looking inside, they can't really see, they think they see somebody, they break in, and you realize there's a woman and two children in there. And this is where everybody has to basically action stations, everybody has to come out and grab them. The rain is pouring, it's very dramatic, and then they all have to go in, you know, they're all taken in, and we realize it's the mother, a daughter called Amy, and a son called Stephen. And we get they all kind of go into different trauma rooms. We've got Carter and Anna are with Amy, who is the daughter, and Weaver. Doug and Green go with the son, Stephen, and Cordae and Benton treat the mom. At one point, Stephen actually, you know, he crashes and they have to try and bring him back, and they have to work together. So we get that Doug and Green kind of having to show the team that they are, showing a good moment of them. We see Weaver being with Amy and being really lovely with her and supporting her and telling her everything's going to be okay. And we see that lovely softness. We see Cordae and Benton having to work together again, having to put their differences aside to try and help. I thought the most heartbreaking is Amy in this story, isn't it? Because she's conscious.
Yeah. She's fully aware. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she says, we were on our way. Dad said, if we come, we'll all just talk to somebody. We were just, we were on our way. We came to talk to somebody. Why did he have a gun? You know, we were only coming to talk to somebody. And it's those fragments again of this, just you can piece together this horrific story.
It is. It's there's just enough said that you understand the terror mm-hmm. that she would have gone through. And there's just enough not said that your imagination is filling in the blanks. And of course, in a way, while obviously they're scrambling to fix everyone, we're seeing the aftermath.
Yeah.
And it's just horrible.
It really is. I thought it was really interesting introduction of kind of mental health and male violence. And I just thought it was a really interesting kind of intersection of that. And who do you help, and how our mental health services aren't really up to scratch, because we need people to really like come in half dead before we do anything. And actually we're not good at picking up on these red flags and going, this could escalate, this could
it's sort of indicative, or maybe indicative is the wrong word, but it's the ER in one. We are reactive as opposed to preventative, and it's nobody's it's certainly not the ER's fault, but this poor, I say poor, but the psych resident who's down, we've seen him before.
Yes.
I mean, he has a fairly thankless job as well, because he has a series of checklists that he has to, like, is he showing signs of probably hurting himself? Well, at this point, no, he's not. Yeah. Does he want to leave? Yes, he does. Is he fully conscious and coherent? Yes, he is.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do here?
He is very remorseful that I believed him. I thought, okay, the way he's so like, I just didn't mean to, and oh gosh, you know, and I think as well, you know, 9 out of 10 people that psych turn away with similar things will stay home. And it's the one that comes, ends up back with this kind of catastrophe. So it's really tricky, isn't it? And then we get this.
It's an escalation, because he was harming himself. No, he smashed a glass out of anger. Again, that's not really violence towards people. It's just, you know, an outlet, and then he decides to use the glass on himself. Mm. Well, that there's no indication there from us as a viewer that he's expressing violent thoughts towards anyone else.
Yes, exactly. It all seems very much on him. Yeah. And all the information we hear is about the fact that he's hating his job and this isn't working that for him. And we get that brilliant thing that ER does actually a lot, and actually why, again, I got a bit emotional towards the end, is because this is how the actual finale of the whole series is as well. You know, action is happening and the camera just pulls us away.
I love that shot. Them.
It was a really clever ending.
Because
I was nearly laughing, because we were coming up to recording time and I knew kind of like, how much is left in this episode? There's an awful lot to happen. Yeah. Like, oh, I like it.
Oh, we're not resolving all of that stuff. Yeah. Oh, okay, and as we say, it's set up lots of different things that is, you know, we've got the Reese thing, we've got kind of the Doug thing, we've got possibly the Max Anna, you know, we've got Green having to reckon with his stuff. Weaver's obviously got to apply for the job. Is she going to get it? We've got Corday and Benton, you know, it's set all those things up for us to kind of come back to. So, yeah, I mean, that is the episode.
Well, I just wanted to pick up a couple of things. So,
Jeannie
having to...
Look after Mr. Neighbor.
Here you go. Here's a live gun. You deal with this. Yeah. And then she has to restrain him in the bed.
Yeah.
And she does it. And I'm like, spine of steel again.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wonder Woman. Do you know what I mean? She should have been cast as Wonder Woman. But anyway. But also the renal patient who...
Oh, this was that again, another that odd
was,
one.
Yeah, there was a fragment again, wasn't it?
And
there was a lot of judgment of the sex worker who has been going around and helping this guy out and making his life better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she accidentally pulls out the
catheter,
like dialysis? Catheter or something like that. Yeah. And I was like,
and he goes into kidney failure, Yeah, it's just...
Well, they leave that hanging, like, well, what are they going to do with her and how is she going to feel? And, it was just half done. It was just such a shame because, like you said, the rest of the episode is massive and classic as well.
Yes, definitely. So, any Ibers? Anybody Iber?
Nobody jumped out at me, to be honest.
Same. I didn't. Dr. Babcock looks like a bunch of people, but it isn't them. So sorry, Dr. Babcock, because I went and had a look as IMDb. I was like, oh,
come back when you are somebody. Is that what you're saying to him?
Basically, yeah.
And are we drugs? Any drugs? Any?
Yeah, so I don't think I've covered this before, but I've heard it a few times, which is spinacrit.
Oh, yeah.
So it's basically short for hemacrit. So they'll take, one of the healthcare workers will use a little lancet and get some blood out of the finger, and then they'll spin it on a centrifuge, basically, and that tells them how many red blood cells are in the blood at that point, and it'll tell them if they need to be transfused because they've lost blood, they're going to be anemic. So you might have heard packed red cell volume or packed cell volume.
Yeah.
So that's basically what it is. It's whether they need extra blood to make up for the fact they've lost red blood cells, and obviously that's going to affect how much oxygen they can carry around the body, which is, I believe, quite important. I think just we need oxygen everywhere.
Just a little. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really simple one. It literally, once you know what they mean by spin and crit, it does exactly what it says on the tin.
Excellent. Do you know what I mean? I love that, yeah.
Yeah, so, and it sounds so dramatic. Spin and crit!
It does. So as it is our last podcast episode for now, did we want to kind of do a bit of a summary or look back, a bit of a favorite episodes, favorite moments, favorite characters?
Sure.
Yes, all around. So the answer to all of those questions is Doug. No.
favorite episode, Doug.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like in four seasons of ER, so much happens. There's a reason ER, I think, lasted as long as it did. And obviously some seasons are stronger than others, and that's fine. Yeah. That's just the nature of television. But also for these four seasons, it's a very contained show for the most of it. Yeah. You know, like 99% of all stories happen in that ER. Yeah. Later on, we'll end up in Sudan, in Darfur. You know, we take in a bit more of the world, and that's fine. That is a thing that happens. But I love how tight these first four seasons are. I mean, the fact that these first four seasons feature George Clooney as Doug Ross
has nothing to do with it.
Not at all. Yeah. And the fact that we get a whole episode of him in a tux in a storm drain as well.
It was
quite. Did you see in our little behind the scenes thing that this episode, the one we've just covered, kind of not accidentally, broke all records for viewing numbers? 47 million people watched this as it aired, because it aired after the Seinfeld finale.
Oh,
wow.
That, and also, you know, it was such a strong following, and it knew, everybody knew it was coming back for season five. So you want to know what it's setting up for the next. This was such must-see TV. And again, it was of a time where there wasn't so much out there. So people, 47 million people could sit and watch something. Whereas now everything's, you know, there's so much everywhere. There's no real.
I mean, how many streaming services have.
Exactly. Watch it there and then.
I can say five or six that I watch on the reg. Do you know what I mean?
And it's of that time, which was very magical, I think. And you know, 90s NBC was the place to be, and this was one of its jewels in its crown. Favorite episodes for me, I think, always for me, is when there's something kind of special about it. So for me, I really love the episode where Carol is out at the shop, and Ewan McGregor's there.
Oh, yeah.
I love that one. I really love the Quentin Tarantino one, you know, all the different, just because it's got this kind of quirky edge. And I just love the storylines that we've already covered. You know, there have been so many. I'm going to shock everyone with who I think is my favourite character right now. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Do we need a drum roll?
You might do, yeah.
Is he played by Paul McCrane?
How did you know? Of course, mine is Dr. Carter. You know, he is, for me, the introduction into the ER. We follow him, we go through his foibles in his life, but for me the thing that I love is he's a good person and he wants to do the right for his patients, and he feels very selfless a lot of the time, and he's young and naive and he's learning and he's growing, and I just think that for me he's so interesting to watch. And he's one half of my favorite relationship on the show, which is the friendship between him and Benton, you know, which I think really pays off by the end. I just absolutely adore all of that.
For me, I don't know, because I mean, I keep coming back to Jeannie, and she impressed herself on my mind when I first started watching it.
Same, yeah.
For her strength, and as we've kind of joked, the ongoing tragedy that they keep throwing in her way, and her resolve and keeps going through it. And she makes mistakes and she has some rough times, and can debate whether she should have gone back to Al and rekindle the relationship, but they were already happy together. And do you know what I mean? They weren't miserable from the get-go. They didn't fall into old patterns straight away.
And just because something ends doesn't mean just because something doesn't last doesn't mean it's not worth it when
sometimes things are more worthwhile for being temporary.
Yeah.
Which is a big thing about life, you know, it's a big point to be made about life. Its brevity gives it value in a lot of ways, but I wish we'd had a bit more Susan, because I did, again, Susan impressed herself on my mind when I was younger.
She was the first woman I think I saw on TV that I was just like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome to me.
Yeah, in terms of favourite episodes, probably I think, as you say, the standalone episodes, like this is a friend's naming tradition, the one in the shop,
one with Ewan McGregor.
Because it had all sorts of everything, it had that DIY medicine, it had Carol showing again her absolute strength and ability. It had a great guest. I'm not a huge fan of Ewan McGregor. I think he's a great actor. I'm not that bothered about him.
No, same, but he's...
I've heard things, that's all. But I've heard rumours that he's not announced. I think the episodes like that one probably stands out the most for me. Anything where, like in this episode, you get that, you know, at one point, I don't know, there was more ER staff in the car than actual victims of the shooting. Because they're scrambling all around and pulling people out. And I love those moments where it gets the blood pumping. It's like watching, if you're into action films, a great fight scene. Do you know what I mean? That kind of...
an adrenaline rush.
Exactly, yeah. And that was... I was making my notes. I keep my head down a lot of stuff. It's when I feel like missile. But this one, it made me put it down and watch and try and somehow write and not look at the page. Do you know what I mean? It was...
Fantastic. It's one of the things that ER introduced to the world, and it's that filmic quality and that not looking at your TV audience as not sophisticated, you know, going, actually they can handle this. And it's why I think it was the show it was and why it stayed so long. And I will always say it annoys me how much that people forget it as the pioneer it was, and other things get picked up and it's like, no, this it started here. But
I mean, the road trip movie, that was a movie.
It was a road trip
episode. Yeah. There's no medicine
in
that. Beautiful. No medicine at all, really. But it sustained it, and it's one of the best episodes of ER, one of the best episodes of television.
Yeah, I think the characters were so knowable. We knew them.
Exactly.
We cared about them. We invested in them, which is why when we have odd episodes or an episode where you don't connect with a character, it's more shocking, because it's like they're so good at connecting us to people. So when you kind of come across one that you're like, why is this not working for us? You know, like someone like Shep as well. You know, why is guy not working for us? Well, I mean, again, I don't think that was because he wasn't drawn that well. I think the way they drew him, you know, made us dislike him, whether they wanted us to or not, we don't know, but that was just our kind of feeling. I mean, this is a seminal show and it means a lot to us, and it means a lot to a lot of people out there. I've loved that, you know, people are discovering it now that weren't around then or just hadn't caught up with it then, you know, and I just love that it's still resonates and still holds up as an excellent, unmatched in so many ways for me, piece of drama.
Yeah,
and it gives you. I've got to say, all roads lead to Romano, because I've joked about him from the get-go, because he is a brilliant love-to-hate character. He's not necessarily kind of like a Disney villain with a goatee who strokes his moustache and goes, "Mwah, I'll have all the money." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's complex. He's
complex, he's flawed, and you know you've worked with people like that.
Yes, and yep. You can see why he's the way he is in a lot of ways as well.
He's insecure. He's incredibly insecure, but talented and very intelligent.
Yeah, and very ego, you know.
Very, exactly, very ego-driven. And not, but which seems to be a foil for his absolute lack of self-belief on a certain level. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit of a, you know, fake it till you make it for him, and he's been faking it so well that he doesn't really, there's nothing underneath anymore maybe, but that's why I find him so watchable, because you want to chin him and or maybe give him a hug because his dad never gave him that. Do you know what I mean? It's like, did dad never say he loved you? Do you know what I mean? It's
Sean, have you got
my favorite episode is Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
But great. I love as well the benzene spill. Yes. For all the reasons you're saying, it's everyone firing all go. And that is, that is among my, like yourselves, among my favorite parts of VR is when everyone works together. It's ensemble television at its best.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, you were saying as well that, you know, that it does get a bit forgotten sometimes. I mean, I think, touch wood, now maybe fact check this one, but I think it has, or certainly had, the record for the most Emmy nominations for any television show ever. Mm. Now, I'm not sure if it has the most wins, but it certainly had the most nominations. I'm wondering if things like maybe Game of Thrones might have pipped that, although ER had 15 years, so maybe not. But it was event television way that in recent times, what we have is Game of Thrones would be the obvious other example for event television.
Yeah.
And then outside of that, there's not a lot of really big contenders for that title. There was actually kind of a few in the 90s.
Yes.
And the kind of 80s, 90s, it was a bit before me, but things like Cheers, things like Seinfeld particularly.
Yeah.
And then ER, you know, because you could tune in and you could see a kind of a comedy show where, what's Jerry going to do this week?
Yeah.
And then the next week you could tune in and everyone is fighting a power loss while also trying to keep somebody's heart pumping with just their hands. And
exactly.
Oh my God.
And the live episode.
Of course, yes.
and the live episode, which for the show that it is, to me, my mind just boggles at how you do something like that, because I can understand it a bit more with a kind of shorter comedy, but something as complicated as ER, and it worked so well. And again, I know that that was really exciting. And at the time, you know, how many people would have tuned in to see that live? I think you all know how we feel about the show. And
it's all right, yeah.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not the best. All right. Yeah.
It's very timeless. So if and when we reconvene for season 5, I think it will feel like no time at all has passed.
I agree.
Exactly.
And I agree.
Barring Christmas, a couple of Christmases. Have we had 2 Christmases on the show?
Well, we're at 75 or 76 weeks. So
pretty much we've been doing this straight on for 76 weeks. Yeah, 76, which is impressive. Mm-hmm. Plenty of podcasts take hiatuses. Elvis, Elvi. Without getting totes emotional because it's Saturday morning, thank you to my co-hosts, I'm so glad we did this. So glad we've built this together. Thank you to everybody who's listened. I don't want to give any notable exceptions, but thank you, Sandy. but thank you to everybody who's listened, obviously, and thanks to Gloria Rubin and all the actors who've, I don't know if they've ever listened to an episode, but thank you for being part of this, and thank you for
interacting with us.
Exactly, yeah. Gracing us with your attention. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, No Wiley thanked us for one of our posts on Instagram, yeah, saying that it was really lovely. And we've had, you know, Connie has been brilliant at kind of, yeah, championing us. As we said, you know, we've had Benton and Carter speaking, you know, and we've had Alan Jeannie also kind of dialoguing, yeah, on our page. And, you know, it means a lot because this is a, yeah, show that means a lot to us. So to have kind of them turn around and go, well, actually, we appreciate this and, yeah, we appreciate your love. It just feels, it feels lovely, doesn't it? And wonderful.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And it's meant the world to us, I think. I would say, you know, this has definitely been brilliant. But I think we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about ER. Don't forget, you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at Set_Pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.